Yes.
Sorry.
And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries and modern mysteries and unfiltered non-corporate news of the day. So tonight I have a great guest for you. His name is Paul Tice. He's from San Diego. He has a fantastic bookstore down there called The Book Tree, and all about metaphysical books and ancient astronaut theory research. And he worked side by side with Zachariah Sitchin, who's a legend in the field of ancient astronaut theory. So welcome to the show, Paul Tice.
Yes, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Why don't we sketch out who Zachariah Sitchin is, first of all, and why he's important to this field. We'll start with that.
Okay. Zachariah is probably the most scholarly person out there who has this approach to ancient astronaut theory. And he was originally from the Middle East, I believe. He was educated in Russia, and let's see. Zachariah went to school in England for a while, and as a journalist, and then he didn't start writing his books until he was in his 50s or so. But he was obsessed with the idea, the fact that we had some kind of outside influence in our early times in history. So.
Sure, some kind of advanced alien third party who built the pyramids, left behind advanced technology, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And okay.
Yeah, he's wrote a number of different books, many of whom out there are familiar with: The Twelfth Planet, Stairway to Heaven, The Lost Realms, that sort of thing. And he's gone into virtually every different part of the world, covering different ancient cultures with each book.
Now, in the 1850s and 1860s, many clay tablets were found in Iraq, and they contained a very strange language called cuneiform, and it was not related to anything based on this earth, not Hebrew, not Greek, or anything. It was in triangular wedges, completely different language. How was he able to understand cuneiform and break the code?
He actually didn't break the code. There were others before him that did, so he was able to use the knowledge that others had to actually study it. L.W. King actually translated the Enuma Elish clay tablets as the Epic of Creation story, which came from those tablets. And then Sitchin later on, he had to basically study by himself and self-teach himself, although he contributes a lot of his research and his success in understanding this to Samuel Noah Kramer, who wrote a number of books, important books on the cuneiform and the ancient Sumerians.
Right. Now, my understanding of Dr. Kramer is that they pretty much thought of it as mythology when they were going through all of these ancient gods. Was that their thesis?
Exactly. Kramer was actually with the University of Chicago, and I think he knew a lot more than what he told, because when you're involved with a high-level institution you're open to being ridiculed, and, you've got a lot of other people that are competing with you, and you've got a lot of status. And so you can't really be a maverick quite so much as Sitchin was, because Sitchin didn't have any of those official ties to academia or anything like that. So he could basically, call it as he saw it, sort of thing. And but I really do believe that Kramer, the way that he couched things, the way that he presented things in his books, you could see that he probably knew quite a bit more than what he was saying, but he was leaving it to others later who could take that and run with it. And
that was back in the 1950s and 60s, when people were not ready to talk about UFOs whatsoever. Now we've had many, many sightings over the years in crop circles and the Phoenix Lights and all kinds of things. So now people are much more open, I think. The 1950s was a very conservative time.
Yeah, I mean, there was still a lot going on with the whole giant rock thing, George Van Tassel, and a lot of the contactee things were going on right after World War II, and the supposed Roswell crash and that kind of stuff. But nothing as sophisticated as what's going on today. You're absolutely right.
Okay, so Sitchin comes along and talks about the tablets and these cast of characters, these gods, demigods, as being real advanced beings who taught humans agriculture and arts and sciences and math and astronomy, and they aligned all of these monuments to the solstices and the lunar calendars and all of this, correct?
That's correct, and what's really interesting about this field is that there are those who, when you mention the ancient astronaut theory to them, it's something that is so far beyond the standard mindset, you know, even today, that people generally, you know, think you're crazy. But what's interesting with Sitchin is what he took things very academically. He took things very scholarly. So he went to the original text. He translated the text. He put things together in that there was no getting around the very large possibility that these were not mythological stories. And when I met him, he wanted to document a lot of this stuff on video, and I had spent about 15 years in the television industry before becoming a publisher, and I had worked as a one-man production team for production companies in about four or five different states, and I related this to him, and he immediately wanted me to go on these trips to document this stuff because he knew how to document this, and there's a certain way to do it, and by going to all these different places, which we eventually did, a lot of the places we went to you don't normally find in your standard, I guess, guidebooks on this kind of thing. But Sitchin knew where they all were. And when you start to piece this together, a bigger picture starts to emerge. And all of a sudden, the idea of ancient astronauts being ridiculous, you know, continues to fade away. Because it turns out that you take one or two examples and, oh, yeah, you know, that's just an interesting coincidence and, you know, that sort of thing. But when you start to put a lot of these different things together, you realize, well, gee, maybe there was, if there wasn't some kind of outside intervention, there had to be some kind of an advanced technology that we knew about to help us do some of these things. There was just more going on back then than what we seem to know about today.
Okay, so you find him to be an ethical person who did not appear to have any bias or anything?
Well, you know, everyone has biases. I mean, Zechariah, he happens to be Jewish, and one of his books called Divine Encounters is devoted to the fact that the true God is Yahweh. And I don't happen to share in that same thing, you know, that same idea. But his, you know, he does have a bias in that, you know, these gods did exist, but he believes that they were and are certain things that, you know, some of us may not agree to 100%, but that's actually splitting hairs. The fact that they were really here is the big leap that people are having a hard time, you know, swallowing.
Right. Now, you went to some travels. You spent a lot of time in Mexico. Why don't we start with Palenque? Why don't you tell us about this ancient city? It's very intriguing.
Yeah, this is the ancient city of Palenque is... we spent a lot of time up in the Yucatan, but we had to go down into Palenque, and it's a jungle city in the southern part of Mexico. And as I understand it, the local guide had told us that 90% of that city is still unexcavated, and that's the location whereby the tomb of Pakal is located, where in the main pyramid there you go down an extremely steep set of stairs, which were originally blocked in with you know, tons and tons of boulders that were thrown down the stairs just to keep people out, and it remained that way for, you know, hundreds of years. And that is the famous sarcophagus lid that I believe von Daniken first made famous with what looks to be a crouching figure at the controls of some kind of a what looks to be a rocket ship of some sort. And that has intrigued many of us for years because of the sophistication of the carving and the work that went into that. Of course, a lot of it can be attributed to the importance of the king who is buried there. And it's just a matter of, you know, who and where this king was from and where the people from Palenque originated.
Right. That artwork is incredibly complex, and appears that there's, like, technology or rocket engines all around it, or gear and equipment, and it's the lid of the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I also know Palenque is aligned with the winter solstice and summer solstice. There's a shadow that occurs, and it almost bisects the temple exactly on the winter morning of December 21st. So it appears they had advanced knowledge of astronomy.
Yeah, most of the Mayans had an amazing knowledge of astronomy. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of excitement now about the Mayan calendar and the upcoming 2012 scenario, because the Mayan calendar actually ends in the winter solstice in December of 2012. And, you know, the Mayans actually had, what's really interesting is that their year lasted 365.242 days.
Exactly, yeah.
And our modern mathematical methods have actually had it figured out to 365.2.23 days. So the Mayan calendar, I don't know how they did it, but their mathematics were so advanced that they were accurate to nearly 1/10,000th of a day.
Right, but what would explain it is that there were advanced beings there at the time who simply handed off the knowledge to the Mayans. I mean, that would make sense.
Well, you know, you would have to know quite a bit to be able to get that right on. I mean, if you didn't have a wider or larger perspective of creation and the days and everything, you had to have an extremely advanced mathematical skill, definitely, to be able to pull that off. And where did they get it from? I mean, it seems that we have gotten a lot from either just completely out of the blue, or some of the myths and legends do say that a lot of this knowledge was passed down to us from somewhere else.
Right, a third party. Why don't you talk about a much larger city near Mexico City called Teotihuacan? Why don't you describe that for our listeners?
Well, in my travels, what I tried to do was climb every pyramid in the world, or every pyramid that I could. And the Pyramid of the Sun is the main big pyramid in Teotihuacan. And that is a monster. And it takes up just as much area or space as the Great Pyramid of Giza, you know, in Egypt. But it's just that it's got a much wider base, and it's not as high. But it took 20 minutes to climb that from top to bottom. Extremely impressive. And there's a lot of symbolism going on there as well. But the way that the city was laid out was very astronomically accurate. You know, it had the sun came up exactly at a certain, you know, point in relation to the large causeway or walkway of the city. And it was so well designed that it's just one of those anomalies, again, where, you know, people were either extremely intelligent, or they got their knowledge from somewhere else. And the Pyramid of the Sun is an impressively built pyramid. And it must have taken, like, decades to build, because there's just so much mass to it.
And what's interesting is that this whole heyday of the society in Mexico appeared to be about the time of Christ to 500 A.D., and then it was abruptly abandoned. And you have to ask yourself, you know, if humans worked so hard to create all this, why would they abandon it? To me, it appears that a third party with advanced technology simply moved on to something else.
Yeah, that is a possibility, although I have seen some shows whereby there may have been some weather changes and drought moved in, and they may have had to abandon it because, you know, there was just not enough to sustain them in that general area as well. But you can't discount the fact that the origins of many of these cities could have been planned out based on the higher technology that and the higher mathematics that were there, could have been planned out by, or at least we could have been helped out in as far as creating these settlements.
And then my understanding is that the Mayans and the Aztecs came along and rediscovered the pyramids about 1200 A.D. and claimed them and used them for ceremonial purposes, but kind of refer to the demigods before them as having actually built them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know that some of those cities were definitely abandoned for a long time. And, I wasn't aware of that.
Right. So let's go over to Chichen Itza on the Yucatan. Why don't you describe that amazing pyramid?
Well, that's a smaller one. And but again, in the spring, you know, they've got that, right when it turns spring, I believe, it's when the serpent shadow goes up the side of the pyramid there. So it was built at a precise angle so that I believe it was the spring equinox?
Yes, the spring equinox, the shadow of the serpent appears on the stairways, which is a pretty amazing sight.
And then in the ball court there's flanking, you know, the ball court on each side, the walls, there's a lot of pictures of the various gods, and mythology was a huge part in Chichen Itza.
Yeah, and we should explain that it was a sport they used to play that was somewhat like basketball and soccer. There was a kind of a cement ring on the side, and they had to kick or throw a rubber ball through it. And all of these depictions of the demigods and the custodial gods were on the sides of the courts.
Right, and as I understand it, you could not use your hands in any way, and these hoops were very high up, and and they were made out of stone, and they're still there to this day, and whereby you had to try to get this ball into, you know, through the hoop to score points, and if your team happened to lose, you lost a little more than the game.
So you lost your life.
Yeah, you lost your head. Yeah, you'd be a sacrifice to the gods. So it was always, that you talk about the big game and the Super Bowl and, you know, what's on the line. Well, there were pretty big games back then, too.
Absolutely. Now, I know you traveled with Zechariah Sitchin to Turkey. Why don't you explain what you found in that region with him?
Well, you know, Turkey on the surface might seem to be, you know, kind of a boring place to some people, but once you start to explore this place, it's just a country filled with archaeological riches. Of course, we went to Troy, where Schliemann discovered Troy, which was supposed to have been nothing more than a myth. And of course, they believed in certain gods at the same time too. So we definitely went to Troy to document the fact that yes, this city did in fact exist, and it's been excavated pretty thoroughly and studied pretty thoroughly, and the next step is to think that if the city itself turned out to be real, what about the various gods that they worshipped as well? And that's a question that is basically the next question in line. So we also went to some other places in Turkey that were relating to the probably about 14th century BC, the Hittites, and we went to one place called Yazilikaya, which is some stone carvings of the gods, and one of them was a giant god as compared to a man that was shown nearby, and then there's a procession of the gods that is carved into this this rock wall, so to speak, and so the gods were worshipped and recognized throughout Turkey in ancient times, and we also went to an ancient city in Turkey called Haran, and Haran was actually eastern Turkey, and there were some security concerns about going over there because even to this day there's political unrest and there's there's guerrilla groups and there's warfare going on over there, but we felt it was very important to get over there because in ancient times, Eastern Turkey was northern Mesopotamia, the home of the gods, the home of the first settlements of humanity, the cradle of civilization, you could call it. And so that was northern Mesopotamia. So we went over there to Haran and found an ancient city there whereby still to this day a huge monument had been erected and was still there that was a monument to the god Sin, which was the moon god. So there's a lot of very, very ancient things still in Turkey.
Right, and they all believed in polytheism, these family of custodial gods. I always say custodial or pretender gods. I never confuse them with the supreme god of the universe, because that's who they worshipped. And it's real important to delineate that they are, if we are correct, they are ancient relatives, our cousins or our uncles or what have you, but they're not to be confused with the supreme god of the universe who created the heavens and the earth.
Exactly. And, you know, when you look at Genesis, you'll find, if you look closely, that there are two different creations there. And it's the second creation, which is basically, you know, creating Adam by crossing genes, I guess you could, is the easiest way to put it, whereby, as Sitchin says, you know, the gods came. And for reasons whereby if we were exploring the universe or if we were exploring the solar system, we would, in all likelihood, be looking for minerals.
Yeah, minerals.
Of
gold,
value.
Silver, yeah.
And that's what they found here.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they found an ancient primitive man. And
right. Now, you were saying before in Turkey you saw this statue of a stone god. We have a pretty clear idea of what the Anunnaki look like because we have all these tablets with pictures on them, and they look like old men with beards, robes, big eyes. They were tall. Some of them were giants. But what did you or Zachariah Sitchin conclude about all of the dragon mythology and all of the kind of reptilian mythology? What was that referring to?
Well, I know that Zachariah will tell you, because there's been a lot of talk about these reptilians, modern-day reptilians, and, you know, Zachariah and Neil Freer both contend that if you look at a lot of these depictions, you won't find any reptilians, or in fact very few. There are just a couple of them, but in animal form, but they weren't in, they didn't look like the way the gods looked.
Okay.
So Zachariah is of the opinion that the gods were not reptilian, and in fact, when you read that second creation in Genesis that I just mentioned, we were created in their image, and it was the Elohim, which is a plural name for God, that is used in that context. So we were created in their image, so they were we weren't reptilian. We are not reptilian. And they looked like us, we looked like them.
Right. Okay, well, that's the most straightforward explanation, you know, and I'm willing to go with that. But what about the Indians believed in the Nagas, who were half serpent, half human? The Chinese believed in the dragon gods, and we have tremendous dragon mythology all throughout Europe with dragons, flying dragons, guarding treasure.
Well,
what do you make of that?
Well, there's a gentleman in England who was unaware of Zachariah Sitchin, and his name is Christian O'Brien, and he wrote a book in 1985 called The Genius of the Few, the story of those who founded the Garden of Eden. And he was working in the 1950s and 60s over in Iran, and he, you know, this guy was an amazing scholar. He didn't know who Sitchin was. Sitchin didn't know him, but he worked for a major oil company. In fact, it later became British Petroleum. And he later became and retired as the head of the Iranian oil industry over there. He excavated ziggurats, you know, the old...
Sure, pyramids, sure.
Yeah, the old pyramids from the Sumerians. And because he had to in order to look for oil in certain spots. And to make a long story short, he did some amazing research And his view on the reptilian thing was that the caduceus that you see in medical, you know, in the hospitals and everything today, which
the
is a symbol
with
for,
the DNA
for,
strand, right? That
yeah.
The doctors use as an emblem, sure.
Exactly. Those who actually did the DNA cross and manipulation between, you know, the godly genes and primitive man in order to make a worker, those who worked in the medical area were actually, the name used for them is translated as serpent.
Okay.
And so that's where our caduceus comes from. It's a serpent emblem. It goes way back. And those of the higher rank were called two-eyed serpents, and then the lower ranks were called one-eyed serpents. So we don't know if they were actually serpents and they only worked in the medical areas like that, or if this was just a sort of a rank that they had, you know, among themselves.
Yeah, we don't know. It's just a puzzling aspect of this whole theory.
Yeah.
Now, what about, well, let's pause for a moment. I want to tell everybody how they can get a hold of your catalog, because you have all of these, you're a great resource for books on all of these esoteric subjects. And I'll tell people about my DVDs on this very subject, the Ancient Astronaut Series. So why don't you go ahead and give out the info?
Yeah, and let's see, you could call for our free catalog. It's 1-800-700-8733. It's also easier to remember by 1-800-700-TREE. And this would be a good test because, you know, the phone call is free and the catalog is free. And we've got, you know, like about 1,000 titles, and we get into, because of our affiliation with Zachariah Sitchin, we published a book for him which is available. We've got all kinds of other material that relates to this. In fact, we do have a book by R.A. Boulay, which is all about...
It's Flying Serpents and Dragons.
Flying Serpents and Dragons, which is all about the reptilian ideas and everything.
Right.
And so, you know, I give my personal opinion, but also at the same time, you can't discount Boulay's book, which is, you know...
Wonderful research on the subject.
It really is, you
yeah.
know. And so Sitchin's take is a little bit different than some of these other people, and it all needs to be researched. And we've tried to make our place, you know, BookTree, a place where people can come and get a lot of really interesting information.
Yeah, so people should definitely get your catalog, and you have a store in San Diego as well, the BookTree. And in my DVDs, I've really summarized the whole Ancient Astronaut Theory. And people can go to the main page at bbsradio.com and click on Odyssey, my show, Monday nights, 8 p.m., and they'll go to my personal webpage, and they will see my DVDs, and just email me for $20. I will send you a copy of the DVD, and I'm using PayPal, the secure provider for fund transfer. But I have over 100 pictures in each of my DVDs. So please check out my Odyssey webpage. So now let's get back to the material. Now, the Egyptians had complex beliefs about the underworld that was taught to them by the gods and how to obtain immortality. I'm curious about the artwork they left behind. The gods were depicted as part human, part bird, part human, part crocodile, part jackal or wolf, part human. What do you make of these art depictions?
Wow. Well, what's really interesting is that we find that... you know, the Egyptians used symbolism quite a bit, and it's hard to figure out what they were trying to convey by using these different symbolism, because sometimes they, you know, they had a crocodile god, they had, you know, these different gods that signified animals, and they used the animal motif in ancient Egypt a little bit more than in other cultures, and at the same time, you find in the ancient Sumerian stories about how they and O'Brien mentions it in his books, and so does Sitchin, that there were a lot of experiments done genetically whereby there were beings that were created that really looked like this. So it's hard to put a finger on whether they were depicting, you know, things that were looking that exact same way, or how much of the mythology was there in them trying to convey a message through a symbol.
Yeah, what I'm thinking is that they were a few thousand years away from the flood, and they had heard tales from Noah's family and survivors about what used to be on this planet, and were talking about the legends, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the flood wiped out a lot of these animal-human hybrids.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, it all sounds like really crazy, and the thing is, you have to read the ancient text. You know, for instance, the Enuma Elish, that's basically the seven tablets of creation. That was the very first form of writing on the planet, and the creation story that's found in Genesis, a couple thousand years later shows up in the Bible. So this is like, we're talking the oldest known legends and myths in the world, but actually a lot of it became legend and myth based on what could have been a true, actual, documented, piece of work on clay tablets. And
right. Just to give people an example, if you look at the clay tablets, they talk about a group of custodial gods searching for minerals 6 days a week, and then they decide on the seventh day they will have a day of rest,
mm-hmm.
where they're not going to work. So you see the origins of that idea in Genesis, of the seventh day we will rest. But what happened was they decided to condense it to one God, right, in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It just made it a lot easier because, you know, in the Old Testament they had decided upon one God, Yahweh, and you just couldn't have a plurality like that because all of the other pagans and were worshiping multiple gods, and if you wanted to be special, you had to have your own god. And what happened was these separate gods did break off and form their own groups and had their tribes and things like that. And with the mentality today that's going on with religions, my God can beat up your God, which basically explains a lot of the warfare that is going on throughout the world. It started back then in a tribal sort of way, and over time the tribes have just gotten a little bit more sophisticated. That's all.
Absolutely. So tell me, these demigods were very prominent in society in 3000 BC in Egypt. They were on top of the pyramids, issuing orders to the pharaohs and priests who would tell the humans what to do. By the time of 1000 BC, maybe ending with David and Goliath, where he slays the giant, we see a fading away of the Anunnaki, of the giants, of the demigods. What do you think happened?
Well, let's see. When this 12th planet, makes it's supposed to come around every 3,600 years,
uh-huh.
and then it'll pass through. And what's really interesting is that it'll swing around the sun because it orbits. It's got its own orbit, just like every other planet. It's just that it's very elongated, and it takes it much longer to go through that orbit.
Sure.
So as it swoops around the planet, the gods are here, and they're doing their thing. But then when the planet comes back around and it's going to leave the area, that's when they suddenly they have to leave.
So do you think around 1000 BC was maybe perhaps an orbit, and when they jumped on and left humans? Just I know there's a text in the Sumerian clay tablets where Anu, the father, comes and he said, "Let the humans have it now. It's we've gotten our minerals and gold, and let it be theirs." What do you think of that?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And if the gods weren't real, and if the gods had nothing to do with looking over us and everything, it's like, it becomes, when you really research this deeply, it becomes an extremely difficult thing to wrestle with. It becomes so much more easy to accept the theory of ancient astronauts when you actually study it deeply. And then you don't feel crazy, and
mm-hmm.
and the thing is, everybody else seems to be crazy because they don't even want to look at it.
Right. Well, there's a passage in the Bible I've been researching recently about King Og, O-G, and it's kind of the last reference to giants in the Old Testament, and it talks about his bed that he slept on was 16 feet high. So, and that the humans used to look at it, it was kind of like an artifact, and kind of marvel at, oh, that's how the giants used to sleep, you know, that's their giant bed. And that's kind of that last trace of it in the Old Testament. But then, around the time of Christ, you have this massive input of Anunnaki influence in Mexico and South America. Does it appear that they all jumped continents and started fresh to get more minerals, copper, etc.?
Well, a lot of people do believe that, and you know, it just seems that, you know, the pantheons of gods seem to have their, you know, their names change, but they seem to have the same.
It's the same. Quetzalcoatl in Mexico has all of the same characteristics of Enki in the Middle East.
Exactly. There's been some things worked up cross culturally between to see which gods would be best depicted in other cultures, and they all seem to match up in, you know, exactly the way that you're saying. There's
right.
Yeah.
Well, it appears that the home base of the Anunnaki, it was in Peru, in the Americas. Why don't you talk about some of the monuments left behind in Peru?
Well, that's one place that I personally had not been, but I know that they're...
You know a lot about it, though.
Oh, yeah. They date back. They are so incredibly old. You know, it's... in fact, when you look at... let's see, the oldest site there.
Well, Tiwanaco is,
that's the
is
one.
It's 14,000 feet above sea level. It's a horrendous place for humans to want to live.
Yeah.
It's barren, nothing grows there, and all of a sudden you've got pyramids up there?
Yeah, and what I was going to mention is that in the surrounding area you've got seashells embedded into all of the land. So at one point, what was 14,000 feet up was once at sea level.
Right, and so it appears that you have a complex city, once again in Tiwanaco, with ziggurats and pyramids, and a lot of these stones are quite heavy. Some of them are 400 tons.
Yep.
And to carve that out in one piece and to move it, I've never seen a logical explanation that humans would do something like that or were able to at that time.
Well, the most amazing sites are the ones that were pre-diluvial, you know, before the flood. And Christian O'Brien dates the flood to have been around 6540 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that the Great Pyramid of Giza is pre-diluvial, although the dating that you will find from the standard so-called experts will put it, you know, much more recent. But when you look at the Sphinx around it and the water erosion that is found around the Sphinx, if, you know, the Sphinx and the pyramid are basically from around the same time, then you're going way, way back. And then you've got the stones at Baalbek, 100-plus ton stones that were, you know, there's nothing that could even lift them. Well, they could be lifted today just barely and moved. But, you know, back then, those are known to be pre-diluvial too. And then also then you've got the South American, the place in Peru that we were just talking about. And these are the most incredible areas in the world with
right.
the most incredible monuments, and they're
what
the oldest.
Baalbek is. It's a giant landing or flat platform in Lebanon. And if you read the clay tablets, they talk about the cedar forests of this area where they needed a giant launching pad for their rocket ships. And here all of a sudden we have this giant stone platform.
Yeah, and what on earth could possibly be the purpose for such a huge, I mean, massive stone platform like that? It just really doesn't make any sense until you start looking at, similar modern-day things where in order to handle the thrust of a massive, you know, ship of some sort, that, you know, you have to have something of that size. But
right. Now, let's get into Eric von Däniken. He came forward in 1965 with his book Chariots of the Gods. Talk about his kind of his early career. There were some troubles with him and how he's really turned it around and become quite a scholar and a leader in this field.
Yeah, that's the thing. Von Däniken was the earliest and most well-known pioneer of this subject area, and he made some mistakes. He he's the first to tell you, even to this day, that, you know, he was young. He jumped to some conclusions, but the basic, I mean, when you're on to something like this, you're going to be excited, and so some things that he reported were not entirely accurate, but
he was the first, so give the guy a break.
Exactly.
The first people to discover America. I mean, Columbus thought he was in what, India or something.
Yeah, and he's written dozens of books, and the first books that he wrote were all published over here in America. But now he's rewritten many of them, corrected the mistakes, said, you know, here's where I was wrong, here, and here, but my basic thesis stays the same. And, in fact, it even becomes stronger. And
it's called the scientific method. You make mistakes, and then you go back, and you correct them.
Yeah.
That's what professors do in colleges.
Yeah, and a lot of his newer books, in fact, all of his newest books are not published in America, and the rewritten ones that corrected his mistakes are not published in America. It's just like, for some reason, he's blacklisted here, and the major publishing companies won't touch him.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah. You can't find his books over here. You've got to go to Europe to get them.
But you can get them through your store, correct? The Book Tree?
Actually, no. You'd have to go through Giorgio. There's a place called Legendary Times, which is actually the outpost of the United States of, you know, basically the Eric von Däniken United States Central, I guess you could say. And it's probably, I believe it may be legendarytimes.com, but if you Google Legendary Times, you'll come up with, Eric von Däniken's all of his newest stuff.
Okay.
And they put out a really great magazine, too, so.
Well, his film Chariots of the Gods was very widespread. It had a lot of distribution, and I think it ran on PBS. I remember seeing it as a child, and just mind-blowing concepts.
Yeah, yeah. He did his homework, and in fact, I went to the very last Ancient Astronaut Society meeting that they had in Florida, which was it was probably like right around 10 years ago, and those things. You know, they found these little gold, they look like little airplanes, they're made of gold, and you'll see them in some of von Däniken's books and stuff, and they found those in Peru, and when I was at that conference, somebody actually recreated them and found them to be aerodynamically sound. They put motors on them, and they were flying them around out in the parking lot, and so they actually flew, and these were dated from, you know, like over 1,000 years BC and something like that, and you know, so there's a lot of technology that has been out there in ancient times. Anyway, if you go and get this one book called Forbidden Archaeology by Michael Cremo, you'll find these incredible ancient artifacts that were found like basically a perfectly rounded ball bearing found in the middle of a piece of coal. And if you know how long it takes coal to form, you'll realize how old this ball bearing was. I mean, and there's hundreds of instances of, you know, people who are building a mall and they'll come across, you know, another thing similar to that, whereby we've had amazing technology in the past that nobody wants to look at. But Michael Cremo collected a lot of cases like that, and it's a big, huge, thick book called Forbidden Archaeology. That's another good one to look into.
Absolutely, and of course, there were batteries that have been found in Baghdad, it appears electricity, you know, generated from these batteries. And the Benben is, I don't know if you researched that, but it appears to be a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a carving of a person in a spaceship, and there's a model of it in Egypt, the Benben stone.
Yeah. And the one thing that people fail to see as being the most, the strongest evidence of them having been here is us. So, you know, basically, when you look at the human DNA, when you look at all the different advanced science can look at the human DNA and see that there's been all these weird splicing that has gone on, and we get all these strange diseases that no other animal species get, And because we've been tampered with so much on a genetic basis. I mean, we're really the best evidence, and yet we're always looking outside of ourselves for the answers, but it's right there.
Well, we know humans used to live to be 1,000 years old, if you remember Methuselah of the Bible, and it appears that our lifespan has been shortened, and we've had some genetic tampering.
Yeah, there's another guy who's written for us, a college professor by the name of Jack Barringer. He wrote a book called Past Shock, which is the opposite of Alvin Toffler's Future Shock. And it's basically the origin of religion and its impact on the human soul. And he gets Zachariah Sitchin's theory down in a nutshell and puts it very clearly in about 120 pages. And he says that these were pretender gods, as you mentioned, that they were calling themselves God, but they were really pretender gods, and we worshipped them. And in Neil Freer, in his book Breaking the God Spell, which we also publish, he says that the true word worship, actually the true meaning of that word meant to work for. And that was the purpose for them creating us in the way that we are today. And when you look at, you know, people who hate their jobs and they go off and they work a 9-to-5 job, yet they won't quit because within them we're all programmed to be workers. And a lot of us, you know, we're not doing what we enjoy, and we just seem to be stuck. And that's because of the kind of programming. Jack calls it, in his book Past Shock, he calls it the slave chip.
Yeah, we all, we have free will, but we have to fight our robotic tendencies sometimes.
Yeah.
Because if you notice, even if you take a class or something, people will sit in the same spot that mm-hmm. they sat in the first time. Or people will drive the same way to, you know, go to work. We kind of have a part of us that's robotic in a way. We have to fight that.
But the good news is that, you know, in the past 100 years, we've basically gone from, you know, a horse and buggy into walking on the moon. So what they've done here and what we've done is that we're into a... we've advanced our evolutionary time frame. You know, our evolution has been speeded up drastically. Normally, when you look at evolution, it goes very, very slowly.
I mean, sure. With all of this advanced technology, do you think the Anunnaki are still behind the scenes watching over the planet and monitoring the situation, or have they left us completely?
Well, I think that they definitely have got their eye on us.
I do too. I think they were so controlling during the Old Testament days, if you go back and read those passages,
mm-hmm.
that there's no way they would have completely left their group on this planet.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I personally believe that they're using secret societies today,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's aspects of Freemasonry and aspects of the Council on Foreign Relations or the Bilderbergs, or just some secretive, powerful groups behind the scenes to monitor the situation. And I think what they want is a one-world government. I think they want a new world order to put all of the sheep, as it were, back under one tent. What do you think of that?
Well, I do know that some of the larger groups, for instance, the Vatican. The Vatican actually owns observatories. And it's been determined that this 12th planet, or, you know, Nibiru, when it will be coming back, will be coming from out of the southern sky, and there's at least two space stations, or not space stations, the two observatories that the Vatican owns, and both of them are pointed into the southern sky. What are they looking for? What are they watching for?
Mm-hmm.
And, the Vatican is just a major force in the world. It's, you know, they've got more money than most people could even imagine.
Right, but what's interesting is the time of the Industrial Revolution, you've got all of a sudden these New World Order secretive groups forming. And to work on a project for 200 years behind the scenes, and very, very powerful influences are working on this right now, as you know. They're pulling strings. They're forming the European Union. They're trying to form a North American Union. They're trying to consolidate, have a world army, World Trade Organization, etc., world tax. So to me, this is a way of trying to control the situation on this planet. Who else could be behind this massive New World Order effort that's been going on for decades? Who else would go to that kind of trouble?
Well, it's really hard to say unless you're really at that level where you could know, you know. It's like, I think that, you know, the gods, should they exist, you know, when you look back at the whole story about the ancient flood, there's another ancient text called the Atrahasis. And that's the story of the flood, the very first Noah, who was not known as Noah in this ancient text because it's far older than the Noah version, but it's, you know, everything that's within that story. And, you know, the gods, they wanted to, it came a time where they couldn't stand the noise that we were making, as they put it in this text, and they wanted to get rid of us. And only one of the gods sided with us and told Noah and a few other people what to do to save the human race. And I just think that the gods don't really care that much about human life, whereby if they really did want to, you know, control things, I think they would just come back and cause another flood or another cataclysm and wipe most of us out and just start over that way.
Sure. Well, there certainly are different characters. Many of them were benevolent and helpful, and then others were quite angry and quite controlling. So just like human beings, they had all kinds of agendas.
Yeah.
So we're winding down now. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about, you know, both of us are very tuned into the alternative media. And I'm just going to mention one story as an example that was huge, that broke this week all over the Internet. But yet, if you were to watch TV, you would never know about this, because television is paid for by commercials by large corporations, period.
Mm-hmm.
And the story that broke is that the government concedes that a vaccine caused autism. And we know there's been an explosion of autism over the past couple decades. And they admitted in a lawsuit that vaccines were an aspect of causing autism.
Wow.
And this has broke all over the alternative media. And I'll tell people right now where to go to get your news. You can go to davidicke.com. You can go to rents.com, infowars.com. Where else do you go, Paul?
Well, I don't go on the website so much, but I subscribe to a couple of different magazines that give alternative news. Of course, Nexus magazine.
Yes.
And there's another one out of Australia, which I highly recommend. I just love it. It's called New Dawn.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, Google New Dawn and check it out, because those guys have been around for a long time, and they don't have U.S. distribution like Nexus, but they are first class, A number one. They cover, you know, everything, just like Nexus does. So check them both out.
And I'm sure that both these magazines will be on this story. I have a brother who's autistic, so this is near and dear to my heart. And this should have been, you know, the top story on the news. And I haven't watched the news in years, but I know if I were to turn it on, it would be, you know, some murder was committed, or endless coverage of the election. You know, just endless repetition about the election. And they're not going to cover a big, important story like this. So I really encourage people to switch over to alternative media. Once again, Infowars.com is good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Alex Jones at Infowars. And what's interesting is, if you go to Google to the most viewed videos, all of these alternative videos are in the most viewed category. I think number one is Zeitgeist, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I would encourage everybody to turn off the TV as much as possible. I mean, I'm still guilty of that, and I need to, you know, do that a little bit more myself. But the internet is where it's at right now, as far as getting, you know, the correct
internet radio too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like what we're doing right now.
Yeah, because there's so much really, really important information that you won't find on TV at all. And, you know, I could get into a bunch of stuff right now, but I'll tell you. It's the corporate masters who are running the whole, you know, TV media outlet. And I'm one to talk. I know. I've worked in the TV business.
You're from the TV business. What kind of censorship did you witness?
Well, you know, I used to sit at the big lit up board and put the programs on the air for a lot of the major networks up in Los Angeles. And you know, the corporate sponsors whereby if you didn't air a program, if you missed a commercial, I saw a lot of people come and go, then you were out the door because you cost the company $100,000 of revenue. And so these are the guys that are telling you what to do, these huge corporations, you know. They're paying these TV stations and radio stations big money to get this message out there, and they don't want anything else out there competing against them.
No, and when you look at news headlines like Associated Press and UPI and Reuters, well, who owns them and what's their agenda?
Exactly.
When you go to Yahoo to get your mail and there's little headlines, and for the past year they pretty much said Obama's doing great, Obama's doing this, so, you know, that's their person they're pushing. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, once again, a group working toward a one-world government, and so is McCain and so is Clinton, by the way. All three are in the Council on Foreign Relations. Mm-hmm. But those are the candidates that have been pushed. So you've really got to read between the lines here.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
We're out of time, so just give us one more time a way to get your catalog and visit your bookstore.
Well, you could go to www.thebooktree.com. And I didn't give that out before, but check it out, thebooktree.com. It's all the books that we publish there. And then our free catalog, you can either download it there and print it out, or you could give us a call at 1-800-700-TREE.
And your store, The Book Tree, is in San Diego, correct?
Yep. If you happen to live in the San Diego area, we're at 3316 Adams Avenue. We're open noon to 7 every day, except closed Mondays.
And I just want to remind everybody, my show is called Odyssey. I'm on first and third Monday right now. And go to my webpage. If you go to the BBS Radio main site, go to Odyssey, Monday at 8 p.m., click on my page, and you'll see my DVDs on ancient mysteries, many of the topics we've covered. I summarize them, and I include a lot of wonderful pictures from around the world. So it's not just me lecturing, it's pictures. And you can order them. Just email me, and for $20 I will send them out. And they're at your store, too, right, Paul?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me, and we will see everybody again in 2 weeks on Odyssey. Thank you for joining me, and good night, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.